The Partially Examined Life depends on your support. To find out how to do that in ways that are cheap or even free, go to partiallyexaminedlife.com/support. So we've talked about Stoicism in previous PEL episodes, and coming up on October 15th in New York City, there's a chance to learn more about ancient Stoicism, its modern practice, and its relationship to mindfulness and cognitive behavior therapy. That'll be at Stoicon 2016. Speakers include Ryan Holiday, Massimo Piliucci, Julia Annis, and Debbie Jaffe Ellis. For more information and for tickets, search for Stoicon on Eventbrite or go to howtobeastoic.org/Stoicon. Stoicon is spelled Stoicon.
Hey, this is the Partially Examined Life, episode 147, part 2, continuing on Aristotle's Nicomachean Ethics, books 6 and 7. Last time we were talking about the intellectual virtues. We're going to finish up on that and then get to self-control, also referred to as continence, and how incontinence can be possible, given that being virtuous, according to Plato at least, is just a matter of knowing stuff. If you know that eating cake is bad for you, you don't eat the cake. That's the way it works. So we're halfway through our discussion now, and I think we've given a good picture of the contrast between how we did things in original episode 5 when we discussed this and where we're at now. Hopefully we've not scared off everyone that they have some interest in these Greek terms of why they're important. Not only is it a way of reconceptualizing, you know, just like Heidegger made up his own terms for these things, but just looking back to the Greek, it gives you a different picture of the breakdown of the human mind and how models of how things work are sort of built into the very language we used. So I think this is all on point. Just merely giving the approximate English terms for these things is not actually going to convey what is philosophically interesting.
Yeah, especially in the context of the categories that Aristotle broke them down into. They really are more clear that way.
So we just finished with phronesis, practical wisdom, even though that is going to have a great effect in the rest of our conversation. That's sort of the most important things. I believe after that, he talks a little about political wisdom, which is less essential to what we're talking about here. What else from book 6 here do we want to make sure to hit?
So we get in section 7 of mine, this distinction between phronesis and wisdom, or philosophical wisdom, Sophia's, you know. So the difference is this sort of practical orientation, and he gives us this idea that with phronesis, you have to be able to deliberate well. And basically, once you know what your end is, use reasoning to get there. Again, Sophia is more in the domain of unifying science and intuitive reason.
Science is about knowing demonstrable things within the realm of the invariable. Mm-hmm. But we had already said that you can't actually get the first principles, though, from this demonstrative reason. That's just what demonstration means. It means you already have the axioms to start with.
Yeah.
Intuitive reason, nous.
Well, he goes further here, right, and he says you can't get them from science or art or prudence, yes, or wisdom. And that leaves us with one, yes, final faculty, nous. And that's where we get, yep, our principles.
Yep.
And there seems to be no argument for, like, what if you think that just nous doesn't exist? How do we convince somebody that there really are? I mean, of course, with any given discussion, you can't prove everything. You have to just grant some things, at least as a postulate. I grant that other people exist. I grant that 2 + 2 does in fact equal 4, or that A and not A is not a...
Well, all we have to do is know that the thing that we do exists. So you could just say it's whatever that capacity that we have that allows us to identify these principles, which certainly can't be demonstrated. We know that. I mean, I don't think we can have any argument about that. There are principles that we use that are simply non-demonstrable. And you can talk about induction if you like.
So the law of non-contradiction is the main example.
Yeah.
If you deny that, then you are just not even a human being.
Well, in fact, Aristotle in the Metaphysics, he says that you can't demonstrate it, but he tries to come up with some reasons why it's true. And ultimately, he says that we would not be able to speak. The very fact that we can speak, mm-hmm, is an indication of the law of non-contradiction.
For Kant, that would be a transcendental argument. Wouldn't that be an argument from practical reason, or is that?
Well, he's not deriving it based on that. He, uh-huh, says, you can't prove it, but here are some reasons why you might agree that it's true, that kind of thing.
But even things like physical, scientific physical laws, you know, you can't demonstrate the
conservation of energy,
the law of gravitation, or yeah, you know, there's a lot of induction, what we would call induction, that goes on. It's not like we can just start with some principles and then suddenly we derive some scientific law. They're basic in some sense.
But if they're basic, they're not based on induction, right?
No, he uses this, or at least in my translation, he uses induction, the word induction, at some point.
Yeah.
To ground intuitive wisdom.
Universal principles can come from induction. In section 3, he says this.
So. All right. Well, we're making a lot about this, and it's one paragraph in the text. So maybe we should say we've defined what intuitive reason is. And then Wes was saying what wisdom is science plus intuitive reason. There you go.
Yeah. But phronesis is different. Again, it's in this realm of the variable, and for the sake of some realizable good, we're in the field of action. So you could be wise. Well, can you be wise without being prudent or having phronesis?
I think you can.
I forget how. Yeah, I think you can.
Though Irwin uses, I think, an unhelpful word, intelligence, for translating phronesis. Towards the end of your section 7, he says, phronesis is about human concerns about what is open to deliberation.
Hmm.
So things that you can deliberate about, that is the realm of phronesis. In contrast to episteme, scientific thinking.
Yeah, we deliberate about what to do. What am I going to do?
Yes, we don't deliberate about the Pythagorean theorem.
Yeah, whether something that we can demonstrate is actually true. That's not an object of deliberation, because it just is.
Maybe your translator is a role-playing gamer, so wisdom has to be intelligence. This is charisma. There's just a very few options of what it could be.
That's right.
That's nice because depending upon your personal variation, you might roll higher or lower correspondingly.
I think we could really run with this metaphor.
We could run really far, especially since I just got back from Gen Con. So.
So why does he say in the next paragraph here, even some of the lower animals can have practical wisdom, namely those which are found to have a power of foresight with regard to their own life? We were saying lower animals can't perform actions at all, according to the terminology here, but yet they could have practical wisdom, even though there's no choice involved. Whereas it seemed before that practical wisdom was connected to choice. No, I can just read the context. Section 7 for us. He just said wisdom must be intuitive reason combined with scientific knowledge. Scientific knowledge of the highest object, which is received as it were its proper completion. That's what philosophic wisdom is. Of the highest objects, we say, for it would be strange to think that the art of politics or practical wisdom is the best knowledge, since man is not the best thing in the world. Now, if what is healthy or good is different for men and for fishes, but what is white or straight is always the same, anyone would say what is wise is the same, but what is practically wise is different. For it is that to which observes well the various matters concerning itself that ascribes practical wisdom. And it is to this that one will entrust such matters. So he's trying to say, even though it seems practical wisdom is so useful, philosophic wisdom is only concerned with the invariable. And how many times does that come up? Doesn't it seem like he's trying to say still that philosophic wisdom is better somehow than practical wisdom? But yes, we would entrust practical. They're really just different spheres. So after that, he says, this is why we say that even some of the lower animals have practical wisdom when they're found to have a power of foresight with regard to their own life.
Yeah, I think the we say means we in a kind of metaphorical, anthropomorphizing way.
We incorrectly say. All right, so I just made a big deal.
Well, and for this reason, we sometimes apply the term, this is my translation, apply the term prudent, even to animals, when they show a faculty of foresight in what concerns their own life. The animals can't be prudent. They can be analogous to that. And he uses that word analogous or a lot. So yeah, there's an animal version of prudence, but it's not prudence.
It's prudent-like for Aristotle.
Right.
Prudent-like. Prudish. No.
It would be interesting to, you know, have Aristotle try to process some modern biological understanding and, you know, experimental observations with animals to see how he would process this distinction he makes of human beings as rational animals, like where he would put that line or how that would feather in between animals and human beings. Because I don't think that he would be insensitive to the kinds of things that have been observed at all.
I think the other interesting thing to come out of this and the next section is the sense in which prudence requires knowledge of both general propositions and particular facts. So, for instance, the sweet things are not to be tasted, the sort of general premise of a practical syllogism. And then this thing is sweet, the particular fact. And then so in section 8, skipping past the part where he's saying that statesmanship in a way is a form of prudence, or they're related, that prudence deals with particular facts and then also with principles that must be derived from experience. And then later on, he's going to say, that's why you should pay attention to experienced people, even when they make claims that can't be demonstrated. They're just more experienced than you.
Well, this is why you should pay attention to old people and not just young people.
Yeah.
And this is also why young people are good at math. In mine, it says, a sign of what has been said is the fact that whereas young people become accomplished in geometry, mathematics, and wise within these limits, intelligent young people, which I don't know if your translation says practically reasoning young people, do not seem to be found. The reason is that prudence is concerned with particulars as well as universals, and particulars become known from experience. But a young person lacks experience since some length of time is needed to produce it.
What section is that?
This is in 8. It's a fourth paragraph.
Okay.
A young man of practical wisdom cannot be found. Yes. Sorry, youngins, our younger demographic listeners.
Yeah, and then he goes on. He says, indeed, we might consider why a boy can become accomplished in mathematics, but not in wisdom or natural science. Surely it is because mathematical objects are reached through abstraction, whereas the origins in these other cases are reached through experience. Young people then, lacking experience, have no real conviction in these other sciences, but only say the words, whereas the nature of mathematical objects is clear to them.
And the other thing coming out of Section 8 that was important is that when we make errors in our practical deliberations, we can make errors in the universal part or the particular part. So it might not be the case that sweet things are not to be eaten, and it might not be the case that this thing is sweet. I could err on both levels.
All right. What about Section 9? Anything interesting in there?
What I found was this distinction between deliberating well and deliberating correctly. So
tell us.
Correctness and deliberation has several types. Clearly, good deliberation will not be every type. For the incontinent or base person, we use rational calculation to reach what he proposes to see and will have deliberated correctly, but will have got himself a great evil. Having deliberated well seems, on the contrary, to be some sort of good, for the sort of correctness and deliberation that makes it good deliberation is a sort that reaches a good. So the difference is that you can deliberate your way correctly and end up at a bad end.
Yeah. And that ability to do that, I think that's what he's going to call denotes later on, right? Or cleverness.
Yes. So merely deliberating correctly is cleverness. And cleverness doesn't have any natural orientation with respect to goodness. It could be aligned with good or it could not be aligned with good. That's not its virtue.
So, if we're good at figuring out the means to any old particular sort of end, then we're clever. But for that to become practical wisdom, the ends themselves have to be good.
And this is why lawyers or, in effect, the pejorative version of sophistry is often admonished, because it's, in Aristotle's language, would be mere cleverness. That is, in the classic case, you figure out a way to win the argument regardless of whether what you're arguing for is true or not. And very classically nasty lawyer-like fashion is you argue your way to win your case, but you're still the criminal, right? Mm-hmm. That is cleverness.
Yeah, if you start out with bad first principles or bad assumptions, everything could be top notch as far as the argument itself goes.
And that's really the most clever kind of argument, right? Is because it ends up being that you cannot wedge yourself into any place along the argument at all. It's that the very beginning of it is the problem.
Yeah.
But that makes it a very, very strong and clever mode. And I do want to be careful not to make cleverness pejorative. It's just, it's not oriented towards goodness, either for goodness or against it. It's just that characteristic of being able to reason to an end via means, regardless of what those ends are.
Right. So it's just important to pick that out, because usually we talk about phronesis as just it's means ends analysis.
Exactly.
And no, that's what cleverness is. Phronesis is means ends analysis plus correct ends. And that ends up being to give away something that isn't actually, I think, stated until section 12. That ends up being really what virtue is. Like, this is an essential characteristic of virtue. It's not just that there's virtue out in the world that you could figure out using reason, and then it's a separate art about, like, well, how are you going to become virtuous? No, it's just talking about virtue at all involves talking about the means to get to it. It means talking about virtue as people actually have it, which means they have to not only have knowledge of the good, they have to have phronesis, which is the thing that connects what their actions actually are to the good.
Exactly.
Means ends analysis. Yeah. Yep.
Just because it's such a nice article, we should direct all of you listening to Anna's essay on PL's site on deinotes, which is the Greek word for cleverness. She talks about it in the context of sophists, but the whole article is really, really good about the roots of the word and cleverness.
Yes, this is our first regular staff writer, Anna Sanduyu, and she is absolutely fantastic. And Mark, can I announce this?
Yes.
And she will be our guest for our next podcast on the Nicomachean Ethics, where we cover books 8 through 10. So
sweet. I didn't know that. That's awesome.
Yes. She is going to sub in for Seth.
That's great.
So
we were, Dylan had just read about the different ways you could think about correctness of deliberation. And the first one would be compatible with incontinence. You calculate means-ends analysis, but you don't actually do the right thing. So that's not really going to get to phronesis. The second possibility is it's possible to attain good even by a false syllogism, to attain what one ought to do, but not by the right means. So that's not what we're shooting for either. It's if you come up with the correct decision sort of by accident, even though you didn't.
Or simply by reasoning wrong.
You didn't have good reasoning.
Yeah, I guess that might end up being an accident. Yep. Yeah, I guess you're right.
And one of the main ways we're going to talk about that when it comes to incontinence is a lot of the talk of continence is just sticking to your principles. So that's going to be part of means-ends analysis, right? If you don't want to get fat, don't eat all the stuff. But if you don't have the right principles in the first place and you're just stubbornly sticking, like, I believe in the Atkins diet and that's the only thing. And no matter how many doctors say, or pick your own diet that you consider a fraud, whatever. No matter how many doctors say that I can't live on Soylent, I'm going to just eat that and I'm just going to stick to that. Well, that is to be incontinent against a false proposition like that might be good. You might end up being more nutritionally sound by violating your resolution. So if you make a stupid New Year's resolution and violate it, then that might be good.
Yes, but it would not be due to phronesis, not by good reasoning. It would not be frenetic.
No.
Yes.
It's your inner phronesis. It's the wisdom of the body.
Whatever it is.
That's getting at. No, never mind.
All right. So I think we can jump past section 10.
Sure.
Which is on, my translation has as intelligence, or it could be understanding in yours, sunesis.
Oh, that's not nous? So Dylan's did nous is understanding, right? And this translation is doing sunesis is understanding.
Okay. So it's literally putting together, sunesis, uniting. So sort of the synthetic activity, you know, he's distinguishing it from prudence in the sense that prudence actually issues commands, whereas intelligence just discerns things. So I think that's really only interesting in what it reveals about prudence there, this idea of the normative element to prudence. So
yeah, in my translation, he calls it comprehension.
Okay.
Yeah, that actually sounds pretty good.
Sounds fine.
And then in the next one is judgment, gnome.
In virtue of which men are said to be sympathetic judges or to have judgment is the right discrimination of the equitable. So this just seems to be referring to the justice chapter that we didn't read, right? That's book 5 or something in here.
That's fine.
Right.
You know, and then he'll say the judgment, intelligence, prudence, and reason, they all apply to the ultimate and the particular. Ultimate as in eschaton, and then particular as in the according to each, katheskaton. So what I find interesting about that is there's a sense in which first principles are ultimate, but there's a sense in which particulars and experience are ultimate. And he'll go on to say that nous, so we're thinking of nous now as this thing where we get these ultimate truths that are alterable, but he'll go on to say that nous is also good for particulars as well. And the thing that nous is good for in particulars is getting at the telos, or the Huhanika, the for the sake of the witch, some often translated as the final cause. So when we sort of detect the functions of things and the final causes of things, when we do teleology and we're immediately intuiting something in particulars, we're intuiting this thing about them with Nous.
So all this just shows that Ayn Rand, in her disdain of intuition in favor of just reasoning, did not actually read Aristotle, even though she claimed to love Aristotle so much, because, wow, there's so many different faculties that make up what amounts to intelligence, that makes up these hexes, these states of character that are knowledge related or wisdom related.
Well, then the section 12, he's going to ask, what are they good for? Like, how can they possibly be useful? He brings up
several objections.
Just because we know what's good to do doesn't mean that we are going to be more likely to do those things. And then if you say, well, prudence is the conditions for the possibility of, like, it's not sufficient, but it's necessary, if you go that route, then he says, well, then it's not even necessary, because you could just rely on other people's advice. You could just do what they say. You don't have to have the knowledge on your person. So it wouldn't be necessary to doing good things. The final objection is this weird that prudence seems to be sort of the master of wisdom and give it orders, because prudence is the thing we saw that issues commands. So then he's going to go and respond to these each by each. But
so this is related to a discussion that we had in episode 5 about, if you approach ethics in this way, talking about virtue instead of talking about moral commands, then, you know, it says here, practical wisdom is the quality of mind concerned with things just and noble and good for man. But these are the things which is the mark of a good man to do. And we are none the more able to act for knowing them if the virtues are states of character, just as we are none the better to act for knowing the things that are healthy and sound in the sense of not producing, but of issuing from the state of health. So in other words, just because you know that a healthy person is one that is fit and looks strong, that doesn't help you in itself know how to become that thing. Obviously, something else must be required for ethics, which it seems pretty obviously that he's already answered the question. Practical wisdom is knowing how to get from the model to the means, how to get from this end to the means. That's what it is.
And he's going to kind of break that down for us, because it'll turn out practical wisdom is deinotes, cleverness, plus wisdom, plus Sophia. And wisdom is the thing that gives us the ends. Prudence, deinotes gives us the means. Wisdom gives us the ends. You combine that, you get
deliberation directed towards the good.
But it's a new sort of interesting development here that Sophia gets kind of folded into prudence, becomes a necessary condition of it, even if it's not sufficient for prudence.
I'm just going to keep saying phronesis instead of prudence, because I just picture this 1930s woman in England
prudence. Is that
exactly?
So, and the other thing you'll say here is that, you know, even if practical wisdom didn't have any results, even if it weren't good for anything in a sense, it would still be desirable in itself. So you can't object to it by saying that it doesn't allow you to do anything. It is a good in and of itself, which is an interesting kind of way of approaching this. Ultimately, to do good things is going to require us to have these moral virtues, these ethicae arites. That's the kind of standard. So we'd started out this whole chapter asking, well, the standard is right reason. Well, what does that mean? And at the end of the section, you get, well, the standard is actually the good man. What is the good? It's what the good man says it is. What is the requirement? How do we guide ourselves if we're going to have practical wisdom? Well, you guide yourselves according to the moral virtue that you hopefully possess or have been habituated to or can work towards. It's not like there's some external standard where we're going to say, well, how do we know what virtue is? And then we're going to get it by this external standard. The virtue is that standard.
In some ways, it's frustrating, but in other ways, it makes a lot of sense. I think you can see it both in ourselves, but also in looking particularly at other living creatures, and to see in which way they're flourishing or being the best that they can be at doing what they do. And it's not so hard to recognize that kind of thing. It's not that you would deny that the oak tree that's been deprived of enough water in crappy soil full of rocks, constrained in a box, isn't an oak tree, but you would recognize it as not being the most flourishing kind of oak tree, one that has all of the things that it needs in the right amount and is free from the constraints other than the ones that it generates for itself. And that is that oak tree doing what it's supposed to do. That's the same thing for human beings. Aristotle doesn't use this word freedom, but I think that's what we're talking about when we're talking about freedom, is that combination of having the lack of constraint such that we can do what we most do, given the things that we need to flourish.
Well, he will say that. He will use this word unhindered, which I don't know what it's translating in section 7, but the unhindered energeia, the unhindered exercise of actualization, exercise of a faculty, and that which he will define as pleasure, actually. But I think, yeah, if we even just think about the health.
Yes, health is a perfect example.
Of the tree or the well-being of the tree. What defines that, the standard, is internal to the tree. And it's going to be different for us just because our biology is different. So the actual workings, it's the functioning and the working and just the way the tree is designed, let's say, speaking loosely, that's where the standard comes from. And it's a noose that allows us to intuit what is good for the tree. But there are boundaries, you know, it really is a standard though. Because, you know, when we look at a tree and when we look at another animal, we're going to get two different versions of what's good for it.
And I'd like the word fittingness, maybe even better than good, in the sense that it is the right amount of the things that it needs in the right way at the right time. And that would be towards its good in the sense where we're saying that the good is that which is defined by it flourishing, doing what it does best or doing the things that it does.
Yeah, doing the work. I mean, your word freedom is actually really apt because it's doing its function, its work, its activity to the highest possible degree because it's not hindered by conflict with other faculties, by all these things that we think of as vice, which are ultimately things that just sort of drag down the engine of those different faculties. It's just the engine going at the best possible RPM.
Well, yeah, and having all of its own components complete and fully functioning as well.
So I do like noose translated as intuition there, as it is in at least my version of the text, because now we've seen ultimate particulars, like I'm seeing red now. How do you know that? Well, I experience it. You could call that intuition. There's no way you can derive that from something else. Also, on a universal thing like the law of causality, you'd have to intuit that.
But that's sensory intuition, and that's different.
Well, but the law of causality isn't sensory intuition.
No. Yeah, if it's the law of causality, is that what you're saying, Mark?
Well, I was saying that, and you had said before, sensory particulars are taken on by noose. It's the ultimate things, and it's the immediate.
Not sensory particulars, but the final causes and the telos, the ends of sensory particulars.
Well, and the reason I was going to say that intuition seems to apply well to that is because, as you were saying before, well, it seems like those are based on induction, if anything. It's just not straightforward. It's not like I see one swan that's white and I intuit that all the swan, you know, and I see enough swans. It's not that kind of induction, but seeing enough healthy swans versus unhealthy swans, then you could intuit, which again is not just, you'd have to kind of be able to identify this one is healthy in the first place in order to then count them up and use induction on it.
You only need to see one swan to know whether it's healthy, actually. I think that's part of the point. Because the standard is internal to it.
But that's clearly false. As an empirical matter, how do you know, like, oh, that starfish, like, how do I know if...
It's a active structure, and you could dig into that structure and see that, oh, look, this is designed to do this, but it's not doing this.
Yeah.
Right?
You'd still need some background knowledge in order to do that. You couldn't just see your first robot, if you don't know anything about machines, and tell whether it's working according to its design or not. You have to know that it's the kind of thing that is designed in a certain way.
Suppose I gave you this little cylinder with two ends resting in a frame where it looks like very obviously the cylinder should be able to turn on its axis. And everything is sculpted perfectly. Then there's this piece of unformed metal that's sitting on top of the cylinder and preventing it from turning. The claim is, and I don't, you know, this requires more thought. I don't think we can just dismiss the idea that we couldn't know without any background knowledge that that little structure sets its own internal standards of whether or not it's functioning, or at least gives us a good idea of what it would mean for it to be able to function, and that we can see that there's something not working there.
It does seem like that requires, if not knowledge of that particular, and experience, excuse me, with that particular entity, it does require experience with a lot of other entities that have their own sorts of actions. And then we would make a kind of analogous extrapolation saying, it doesn't seem to be working right. It seems to be trapped or caged or constrained. And we'd have some idea on how to set it free, but that would be based upon experience with other sorts of things that were similar to it.
See, to me, yeah, I'm not so sure how much experience. I mean, I think it's an interesting question, but I had started thinking about this a lot, just trying to understand final causes. And it might require less experience than we think. And there's also just this concept of there's such a thing as structure and lack of structure. And there's a way in which things are formed and have more form or less form. And I'm not sure those things are as contingent as we might think they are. But for me, it requires a lot more thought. But I think that's part of the idea here.
All right. Well, I think just using his own examples, it seems clear to me that an old person with the experience of lots of different things would be better at that kind of thing than the kind of young person that he thinks would readily grasp geometry. That it does not fall into the young person's skills.
Well, that's in the realm of prudence and reasoning, as in dianoia, discursive reasoning and all that stuff. But with Nous, we're talking about intuitive reason, like the same sort of intuition that Descartes tells us that we must have of substance with the wax. That's the whole rationalist function here. And I think it's specifically geared towards these final causes, and it's supposed to put us immediately in touch with them non-inductively. I may be wrong about that.
All right, we're going to stop for a minute and listen to the glorious voice of Seth tell us about our sponsors.
Hey folks, like so many of you, I'm constantly learning for the pure pleasure of it. And that's why I love having a subscription to The Great Courses Plus, because there is always something new to learn. The Great Courses Plus has a huge library of engaging video lectures presented by top professors and experts. There are literally hundreds of topics you can explore, including philosophy, history, science, even hobbies like photography and playing chess. And there are new courses added all the time. Now, I'm currently checking out The Great Ideas of Philosophy, which I want to recommend for this particular episode because in Lecture 14, which is the third in a series on Aristotle, Dr. Daniel Robinson talks about Aristotle on the perfect life. So he's touching on the issues that the guys are discussing here around continence, around eudaimonia, around what is the right sort of life and the way to live it. But he puts some context around it by discussing a broader set of Aristotle's corpus, including causation, and he ties it into justice for the state as well. So I'd highly recommend you check that out. With the Great Courses Plus subscription service, you have the flexibility to stream lectures like The Great Ideas of Philosophy anytime, anywhere, from any device. And as one of our listeners, if you sign up today, you'll get an entire month of unlimited access to all of the Great Courses Plus courses for free. So start your free month now. You can sign up at thegreatcoursesplus.com/PEL. That's thegreatcoursesplus.com/PEL. For those suffering with an addiction problem who have unsuccessfully attended treatment, there is hope. The National Institute on Drug Abuse claims there is no single treatment option that is right for everyone and that treatment should address the multiple needs of an individual and not just the drug use. Recovery should move beyond coping with addiction to helping people thrive. Gulf Breeze Recovery's Thrive program is a holistic non-12-step treatment system that not only treats the true underlying cause of the addiction, but also addresses the individual's physical, spiritual, and mental needs. Gulf Breeze Recovery helps people discover a fresh new outlook on life that enables them to be captains of their own ship. The waterfront facility is neat, clean, comfortable, offers private and semi-private rooms, a lighted fishing pier, and a large swimming pool overlooking the water. You can view the webcam, take a virtual tour, and get more information at gulfbreezerecovery.com or call 855-9-HOLISTIC-REHAB.
Let's move to book 7, please.
Yeah.
Let us now make a fresh beginning and point out, well, we don't have to start reading from the beginning, but that's just how he starts it. We're making a fresh beginning and talks about the difference between vice and incontinence. And the initial way that he sets it up is a little unhelpful, but we've already established that animals don't make decisions. So they can't technically have vice, right? They can't decide wrong because they're not deciding at all. They're acting according to desire without deliberation. And then he just contrasts that with people in the middle and gods who have an excess of virtue, that they too somehow action is not applicable to them because they would just act virtuously automatically. They wouldn't have to make a decision at all either. So those things out of the way, we're just restating what the kind of creatures to whom virtue and vice apply to. And we're going to compare and contrast that with continence and incontinence. that those seem clearly different things. They both result if you are incontinent with regard to the good, or you have vice so that you actively will the bad. Well, the bad thing happens either way, but wouldn't you think that the merely weak, incontinent person who knows the good, is trying to do the good and just fails, is still a better in some way than somebody who actively wills wickedness?
Well, he does.
Yeah, by the end of this, incontinence is going to turn out not to be such a bad thing, actually. It'll be contrasted to vice, to when what in my translation is profligacy.
My translation is intemperance.
Okay. There are lots of positives to incontinence.
Well, the positive, it seems, with incontinence is that you are actually thinking rightly. And the big deal with incontinence is that it's curable. In many cases, it's curable.
Yep.
Because you're basically pointed in the right direction, you can imagine habituating yourself back towards continence. And he makes a link that the incontinent is like the drunk, right? That they make bad decisions, but not because they don't know what they're supposed to be doing.
Well, they know and they don't know at the same time. Yes, yes. They know their knowledge gets suppressed or, you know, overrun by passion, or that's the drunkenness analogy.
Yeah, or if we just avoid even requiring that every time you act, you have knowledge, it's that they don't act on that knowledge. But the intemperate person, the profligate person, reasons wrongly, and they can't be cured from that.
Well, except that you could argue with the person and perhaps change their mind. And that's kind of simpler than having to rehabituate somebody, is to simply change their mind.
Well, that's an interesting question. Aristotle doesn't think that that's simpler. It's an interesting question of what kinds of degrees of difficulty we're talking about here. Because the intemperate person is utterly convinced.
They have the wrong ends and they're totally convinced that they're the right ones.
Exactly. And they're able to, you know, reason their way to them with whatever cleverness they have, but they have the wrong ends. Whereas the incontinent person doesn't have the wrong ends. And that's what makes it easier.
Why is totally convinced part of the definition there? You could have any degree of certainty and still act on your principle. And if you're acting wrongly, then that's vice. Maybe your parents had criminal tendencies and they kind of gave you bad examples. And so you thought that, you know, stealing's okay. But once you get exposed to people with a different opinion and see how screwed up your parents are in other ways, it's not that you've been convinced. You might just not have thought about it critically at all.
Yeah. And that might be a good point to make to Aristotle. I see where you're going with that, Mark. It seems to me that Aristotle doesn't allow for that or doesn't consider that particular version of that the good thing or beneficial thing about the intemperate person in this respect is that they might be able to be convinced because they are reasonable and strongly follow their reason. And so if they get put onto goodness, align their ends with good ends, that they might be even more quickly successful than the incontinent person. Because he doesn't take up that case.
He will even say at some point that their desires are not that strong. There's something cold-blooded about them. So with the incontinent person, they're struggling with strong passions. They know the right thing to do, and they're struggling with strong passions, and they just can't resist that extra piece of cake. The profligate person, there's no battle like that. And it's not even like the extra piece of cake is this passionately desired thing. It's just doesn't matter to them. You know, if it's unhealthy to eat the extra piece of cake, they don't see the unhealthy thing as of any consequence.
And that's the key, right? Is that the reason why the incontinent person for Aristotle is easier to put on the right path is because they have desire. They have something that can be changed. Whereas the intemperate person, because they don't have desire in this direction, they're like a ship without a rudder, right? You can't turn them.
He does raise some people are incontinent because of just habits they've gotten into, and some are just it by nature, and uses women as the example.
Where's that?
Right from the beginning, he talks about incontinence as effeminacy or softness. Somewhere in here, he raises the degree of difficulty in retraining someone, and if their incontinence is just due to habit, habits are always going to be easier to correct than nature. So it could just be that by genetics, by their makeup, they're just going to be the kind of person that is going to be easily victimized or overwhelmed by their passions.
Yeah, so softness is not effeminacy. It's just the word is malakia.
Our translation uses softness, but never uses the word effeminacy for softness.
And it's not, as far as I can tell, the ancient Greek has no association to effeminate.
I've got in section 7, I just did a search on effeminate. It's the third paragraph from the end of section 7. The man who is defective in respect to resistance to the things which most men both resist and resist successfully is soft and effeminate. For effeminacy, too, is a kind of softness. Such a man trails his cloak to avoid the pain of lifting it and plays the invalid without thinking himself wretched, though the man he imitates is a wretched man.
The word that I have there is luxury is a kind of softness, not effeminacy.
Ah. Yes.
So the context is the incontinent man is opposed to the continent, to the soft is opposed to the man of endurance. So it still has soft in your...
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So right before that, it says the continent person is opposed to the incontinent and the resistant to the soft. The resistance consists in holding out and continence in overcoming, but holding out is different from overcoming, just as not being defeated differs from winning. Hence, continence is more choice-worthy than resistance. Someone who is deficient in withstanding what most people withstand and are capable of withstanding is soft and self-indulgent, for self-indulgence is a kind of softness. This person who trails his cloak to avoid the labor and pain of lifting it and imitates an invalid, though he does not think he is miserable, he is merely similar to a miserable person.
So David Ross is a dick and thinks that effeminacy is a good word for...
Or he's just living 100 years ago.
What was the word that you just said for something is a kind of softness? Yeah. Self-indulgence. So, yeah. There you go. Self-indulgence. And wow. See, I've got self-indulgence all over this translation. That is why the self-indulgent man is worse than the incontinent, is just a few.
So the self-indulgent is the profligate,
yeah.
Is what my translation is profligate, and Dylan's is intemperate.
Yeah. Profligate, intemperate, yeah. Self-indulgent. Wow. Okay. So the translation simply swap the terms around. It's not just different. It's like, oh, I've used that one already for that word. I need to pick something else. So maybe effeminacy was just all that was left on the table.
Yeah, an unfortunate choice.
So the word in Greek for profligates, you could also say undisciplined, is a koleston, in case that helps.
Yeah, undisciplined seems not strong enough because it's really talking about wickedness. It's talking about somebody that intentionally goes to excess. So self-indulgence, I kind of like that you allow yourself. That's not just being undisciplined. Incontinent sounds undisciplined.
Yeah. Okay.
But somebody who's actively anti-disciplined.
Yeah, and self-indulgent or intemperate, those all convey the active sense of reaching out.
I guess intemperate doesn't convey anything to me. That's not a word that I'd use in my normal speech.
Yeah, we get habituated to it at St. John's.
We haven't thrown out thumatic yet, so we're safe.
Do you warn your children against intemperance?
Do you cultivate and tame their thumatic nature?
Is that part of the routine? I don't even know what that is. I don't know what your thumatic nature is. You to do with your thumos.
Spiritedness.
Ah. I can't find the spoon that goes with the thumos. I can't bring my soup to school today. All right, so we're not going to go through this section by section. What are the interesting points that popped out to you in here? Can we at least, first of all, sum up again the connection between the previous chapter and this chapter is we've said if you don't have phronesis, then you don't have all the pieces. You don't have both being able to grasp the universal proposition and the particular proposition and take it all the way to action. So that's the way he's putting these arguments and how the incontinent person fails is that they might grasp the universal proposition, but somehow they don't make it to action. Something goes wrong with there. And merely saying, well, they don't have phrenesis. That's not so. What is, you know, we already said that they're kind of like they're drunken.
So actually, that's something we should look at. That's in section 3, that whole thing with the sweetness.
Sure, let's look at that.
That was actually, for me, one of the most interesting parts of the whole thing. And we could read a little bit. So he'll say, so again, one may inquire into the cause of this phenomenon of incontinence by arguments based upon its special nature. You may have a universal judgment and then a judgment about particular facts which fall at once within the province of sense or perception. But when they're two joined together, the conclusion must in matters of speculation be assented to by the mind. And Mark, yeah, I know you already mentioned this, but all sweet things are to be tasted. This thing before me is sweet. And then if you have the power and you're not hindered, you cannot but once put the conclusion, this is to be tasted, into practice. So then he goes on to describe the case with incontinence. Now, when you have on the one side the universal judgment forbidding you to taste, so sweet things are not to be tasted, and on the other side the universal judgment all sweet things are pleasant, Which is an odd way to put that, right? Because we would think that the other side is just all sweet things are to be tasted. But anyway, all sweet things are pleasant. With the corresponding particular, this thing before me is sweet.
Those two things go together.
Then though the former training reasoning bids you avoid this, appetite moves you. For appetite is able to put the several bodily organs in motion. Which I take to be appetite is able to make you do things, whatever the other syllogism says. Like whatever your state of knowledge, I think. And thus it appears that in this way, under the influence of reason, that is to say, the opinion, that people act incontinently. Opinion, too, that is not in itself, but only accidentally opposed to right reason. And this is really the most important sentence. For it is the desire, not the opinion, that is opposed to right reason. And so animals can't be incontinent because they have no universal judgment, but only images and memories of particular facts. So I think we should unpack that. Because that's actually kind of confusing, all of that.
And yet we think of animals, when they shit on our rugs, as the most incontinent of all.
That's the next. You're just reading, right?
Yeah.
So the opinion in question is that all sweet things are to be tasted. But it's not this opinion, all sweet things to be tasted, that is opposed to right reason, but the desire itself. So it's not like when I'm incontinent, I have these two conflicting major premises. No sweet things are to be tasted. All sweet things are to be tasted. That's not the way it works. And then, you know, there's this clash of the syllogisms. It's, I still kind of know that no sweet things are to be tasted, but I also know legitimately that sweet things are pleasant. So that doesn't contradict the other major premise, but that comes into play. So desire, that's why it's the desire that's opposed. Do you see what I'm saying?
Sure. It's the thing has multiple properties. And if you were thinking clearly, you would prioritize the one that really most should affect your action. But the other one is so sparkly. And
it's like, you know, straight up question of adultery or something like that, right? The sweet tasting bonbons, that doesn't get across the sense of what you're talking about. You know, you could also say the universal belief or the universal principle is that you are
that all sweet things are to be tasted. Oh yeah.
No, it would, wouldn't it be that when you're married you are true to your spouse and you don't have sex with other people, but having sex with people is pleasant, right? So that's where the conflict comes in, right? That you're incontinent with respect to your oath that you made, the promise that you made, what you know is the right thing to do.
I was just trying to figure out if that major premise that you just gave there could be stated without using particulars.
Oh, but to make it universal?
Yeah. Obviously, you can, but it's less obviously something just graspable by noose. It seems like it's a custom. Or the way you put it is, I made a particular commitment. So that's talking about a particular. You made this commitment to this other person in particular. It's not just that you're assenting to the property, the universal moral law that anyone who gets married, it's bad for them, in the same way that you have to sort of look at the telos of a relationship.
No, no, you don't have to. You just have to have the universal that oaths are to be kept, right?
You could have any number of universals. You know, it could be oaths, it could be marital vows to be kept. Or
I think you're right, Mark, to point to that the example I gave might involve particulars in a way, but I think that you could make it involve universals. And maybe I'm not being strict enough with Aristotle.
Well, one of the premises is always going to be particular. Marriage vows are not to be broken, but this particular woman before me is sweet.
Or does not fall into what I'm allowed given my marriage vows. That is the particular.
Yeah, I mean, that's the way I was reading it, but I was just trying to come up with something that was more viceful, right? Maybe that's why Aristotle picks this one, because it seems less controversial or less about particulars, right? So it follows your cake eating example for your birthday.
Well, maybe it just is a matter of the kind of things that he considers virtuous and not virtuous. He's not a big rule-based guy in terms of the examples he gives. It's more about, you would really have to look at too much sex versus too little sex and you know, what is healthy for a person. And maybe part of that, you could make an argument that what is healthy for a person is to be, at least when they're in a certain age or whatever and have had certain life experiences, to be in a monogamous thing, and therefore keeping to that is comparable to keeping your weight at an appropriate level or keeping a certain level of athleticism or any of the other health-related things that he otherwise gives. It has to be something about the health of the soul. It can't just be some arbitrary social rule.
Yeah, that's why I wanted to make it in terms of oaths and promises.
Yeah, and it does seem like we made this kind of joke a lot in episode 5 that if something is a rule, like, oh, what's the right amount of pederasty, or what is the right amount of, so what's the right amount of loyalty breaking? Like, it seems none. Like, that seems to be, if you say that loyalty is a virtue, then maybe you could imagine like being just too loyal because the person you're being loyal to has really flipped out and wants you to destroy everyone else in the world. Like, well, that's the point where loyalty should come to a stop.
Yeah, and he would make exactly that kind of reasoning, right? And there are some things for which it's not the truth that for every virtue that there's a mean that is in the middle between two things.
I wanted to reemphasize this interesting idea that it's under the influence, yes, of reason, which is to say of opinion, that people act incontinently, which sounds weird, but the opinion in question is sweet things are pleasant, which he says is only accidental, right? Because we need desire. It's desire, not the opinion, that is opposed to right reason. It's just sort of manifested in that kind of universalized principle. If we didn't have the desire, it wouldn't mean anything. But for animals, there isn't this general thing, you know, sweet things are pleasant, even though they may be conditioned to act that way, right? To go for sweet things. But you can't be incontinent unless you have this ability to have these universal judgments, according to Aristotle, which is fascinating. In other words, it's not just we think of the irrational part and the rational part, and it's not just the irrational part that's responsible for incontinence, but the rational part as well, in the sense of that it produces these principles.
So if you want to pass the Turing test, if you're an AI, just you should act incontinently.
it's the sign of the reasonable person.
Yes.
Yeah, and some more of this comes up in section 8, where he's talking about incontinence and intemperance. And again, it's the relationship to reason that you make the distinction. As we said earlier, that incontinence holds the right thing, but fails to act properly. Whereas the intemperate corrupts the origin, the first principles themselves, the ends. And that ends up making the distinction between the two. That incontinent is contrary to reason while knowing correct action. So when you're incontinent, you act in the wrong way, which you know you shouldn't do. So in that way, it's contrary to reason. But you all the time know what the correct action is. Whereas the intemperate person acts according to reason, but with the wrong ends.
Yeah. He says in my translation, deliberate choice. So I think,
yeah,
we're back to choice again. So
what do you guys think about his insistence on this absolute difference? Like, I feel like in practical situations, and maybe this is, we engage in a certain amount of self-deception, or we take advantage of the fact that we're really not completely sure about these things. So, you know, maybe you have certain beliefs about masturbation being bad for you or something, or even the judgment of how much is too much, that you could kind of have in your waking hours a certain principle. Maybe you were told you'll go blind if you do that. And so you kind of believe that and you try to stick to that. But then as a way of convincing yourself at the time that it's okay, you're like, really? How could that make you go blind? You could kind of be skeptical about this universal principle that you supposedly accept. And aren't there things about almost any principle like that, universal principle, whether it's about health or just about almost anything that we think is the best course of action? You know, I really want to become a better player of my instrument, and so I'm going to practice every day. But then practicing gets hard, and on some particular day, I would rather lie around. And so it's not that I know, no, I objectively do want to become better at my instrument. I'm just kind of, I'm reprioritizing as I go.
So you're worrying about the distinction between intemperate and incontinent?
Yes. And some of that just comes down to a matter that these things, he considers, of course, what goes into phronesis is not only being able to connect your actions to the universal, but having the correct apprehension of a universal in the first place. And we've only used these easy examples about health and eating sweet things or whatever, but even just getting into the, well, what exactly is wrong about infidelity? Is it that you're breaking your rule, or is it that you're hurting the person? And so maybe, well, if she doesn't know, then it's fine. Like, so you kind of decide how to formulate.
No, that's the thing. The wrongness would have to come from the malfunctioning. And that's actually in section 8, he says, you know, again, to the something that he said earlier, which I was just looking at because Dylan was just there, but basically, that in matters of conduct, the end that you're aiming toward is not something that can be demonstrated, but it must come from the virtue of temperance. In other words, it's having the virtue of temperance that defines the end, but something like that.
Yep.
It stuff is very hard to explain. Trying to get at the real teleological picture, but being so constituted in a certain way that to exercise your faculties in such and such a way is one way is high functioning and one way is not. And that's the standard.
He does admit that there is some overlap in ways in which the intemperate and the incontinent overlap with one another. But he does insist on the distinction, one being the orientation with respect to first principles and another being the orientation to goodness. So in section 7, he says, one person pursues excesses of pleasant things because they're excesses and because he decides on it for themselves and not for some further result. He is intemperate, for he's bound to have no regrets and so is incurable, since someone without regrets is incurable. And he continues this idea in section 8, saying the intemperate person, as we said, is not prone to regret since he abides by his decision when he acts. But every incontinent is prone to regret. Hence, the truth is not what we said in raising these questions, but in fact, the intemperate person is incurable and the incontinent is curable.
So let's at least put aside the questions. I know you could put moral quandaries in terms of how much disloyalty is too much, but that's kind of stretching it. The things that he's concerned, to be fair to him, we really should need to concern only the things where we're kind of contemplating where is the golden mean, and being wise, having temperance at all is supposed to tell you where the golden mean is. I think in real situations, we often don't know. So the question is, how much is too much or how much is too little?
Yeah.
So let's say you're trying to diet. You want to eat less, but then you end up starving yourself, becoming bulimic, eating too little. In other words, indulging in the diet too much.
But that seems to me where the process of figuring this out has to do with some sense of practical wisdom and being
yes.
attuned to what is fitting, right? And so without knowing that the person who has good practical wisdom and is attuned to that would, regardless of the diet, as they started engaging in it, there would be a fittingness that they were able to discern out of that activity.
Well, in this case, I think the knowledge actually, so it's non-theoretical, it's what we would call procedural or tacit knowledge, and it comes
yes.
from habituation. So to know what to do in any given situation, you just have to have been antecedently habituated in such a way that you have the virtue. That's the weird, I think, radical claim about this, is that there's nothing independent of that. It's like saying I would see it if I knew it.
But it's not so crazy. We do this all the time, right? When you learn how to tune a guitar, or you learn how to...
Or I think even playing the guitar is a good example.
Yes, maybe. Or playing it where you're getting feedback, you're listening. Even if you don't have something to compare to, you end up picking something that sounds right. And when you first do it, you're constantly moving too far away from that. You're exceeding and receding from that, something that sounds good. And as you practice and do that more and more, you get better at staying closer and closer to what sounds good. And in that way, it's just like the way he describes habit right from the very beginning. Virtue is doing the right thing. And how do you become virtuous? Is you do the right thing.
With guitar, it's, you know, what's good is defined by this sort of antecedent historical community of practice, which is not to say it's not related to human nature. But in cases of virtue, you're anchored in the structure of the organism and all that stuff, the nature of the organism.
Yeah. I mean, another example that I would use is sailing, where you are trimming the sail with respect to the wind. You want to go in a particular direction, and you let the sail out too far or pull it in too far, and the boat goes through a range of speed. And you just naturally find, based upon the direction and the speed you want, looking to try to optimize that speed, where that is. And you, when you first start doing it, you adjust it too far one way or the other, and you gradually, just by doing it, you get a sense of what you should be doing.
Yeah. You know, when someone teaches me boating, there's a set of uncontroversial goals mm-hmm. involved, you know, just being able to move.
You're always aiming towards something.
You know, the wind
yes.
push you, or speed, or, and so there's no controversy when someone, you know, is teaching me how to sail, I don't sit there and go, well, what if moving isn't the good of the boat or my good, right? I don't have to ask that question. I don't have to. It's just, you know, there's a clear thing we have to do, and then someone habituates me to that. But with virtue, I can always ask that question. I can always, when someone is habituating me, and of course, this is like a constant cultural problem, right, that we're faced with. We're all habituated into certain ideas of what is good and what is virtuous, but there's always the question of whether it really is. So you see what I'm getting at here?
It becomes a question of how do you become attuned to what are the signs of your own flourishing?
Exactly.
And then that way you can remain directed towards it, and you can get a sense by being attuned to what those signs are, whether you are deviating from there or not. And, you know, you see this basically in all kinds of self-help, right? The first thing they try to do is point you towards what the signs are, and then point to how you evaluate where you stand with respect to those signs. Oh, you know what? You actually aren't very healthy. Why? Because whenever you walk up the stairs, you get out of breath, and that's actually a bad thing. Now, the fact is, for some of those things, I think that just by your own being an organism, in your own living, you would, for most self-reflective people, you feel like, you know what? There's something wrong with me not being able to walk up, you know, a flight of stairs without being out of breath.
Yeah, this makes me think of it in the case of virtue. It's sort of like coming to boating, except that no one's told you what a boat is for. And you have to figure that out on the fly from the way it's structured. And it is structured so that it can do this certain thing. And you have to find out what that is. But I think that's actually doable. And I think it's doable yes. In the case of virtue as well.
But given that we're political animals, given that we are raised with all these norms, we're really never going to be in a position where we're figuring out from scratch in the way that you just described.
Yeah. And in fact, in the worst possible case, you might be inculcated with a culture that is actually cultivating things that are bad for yourself.
Yeah, so that is the sense in which we do have to figure it out from scratch to some extent. I mean, hopefully we've been given enough.
Yeah, you'll go blind.
We've been given enough good things, because if it's all bad, right, then we're screwed. Because it's not like coming to sailing and we don't know what the boat is. It's being completely damaged before that.
Being suicidal. Yeah. That if you take out to learn boating with that, suicide might be one of the goals here.
No, the analogy is just being given something that's hardly even resembles a boat. It's full of holes. So how am I going to figure out, you know, if I've been habituated badly, my boat is full of holes, and how do you even get a clue of how to? So you have to have enough good things and then go from there. But certainly we need correction from whatever direction we've been given when we're young. Unless we're really, really lucky.
Well, and that's why at the very beginning of the book, Aristotle thinks that proper education makes a huge difference. It may be that you can, over time, figure these things out for yourself. It may be hard, and it may be rare that you actually completely do that on your own. And it certainly makes a big difference if you're habituated well. And it makes a huge impediment if you are habituated wrongly, if you are raised poorly. It causes you huge problems in trying to flourish.
So we are circling back now to things that we covered in the previous one. And given the time, I think maybe we should move to closings, though.
So we haven't really gotten into the pleasure thing, but I think the really interesting part of it, we could say very briefly, because you were talking about being out of breath. And pleasure is actually, for Aristotle, a really good guide star for figuring out what is good for you, even though we can have pleasures in excess and so on and so forth.
Yeah.
So he's going to reemphasize in this section that an activity or an energeia, which you could also translate as the exercise of a faculty, the exercise of a hexis, that is the end when we're doing something. It's an end in itself. It's not for the sake of something else. But pleasure sort of supervenes on that.
Wasn't it indicated by pleasure?
Well, he even defines pleasure at some point as something like the unimpeded exercise. Okay. Yeah. So he's doing this in the context of arguing that pleasure is not a transition or a becoming, as some people would like to argue when they're trying to say it's a bad thing, because it can't be an end in that sense. But it is an end. And he calls it the unimpeded exercise of faculties in their natural state.
I think it's actually a great way to close off, because the next part of this chapter and then going into the friendship books are about pleasure. And then he recapitulates that in the last book. And you're right. I think it's really the right thing to point out. is that that is the guide, is happiness, and happiness involves the proper understanding of pleasure. And part of that is just the normal way we think of pleasure. It's pleasant. It's nice. It feels good. And that part of happiness is it feels good. And that's part of how we get directed towards virtue, is it makes us happy and it feels pleasant.
Yeah. So here's another quote from section 13. So since every formed faculty, hexis, admits of unimpeded exercise, it follows that whether happiness be the exercise of all these faculties or of some of them, that exercise must necessarily be most desirable when unimpeded. But unimpeded exercise of faculty is pleasure. And earlier on, right, just to remind you, he said pleasure is an energeia, and it is an end in itself. So he concludes here, a certain kind of pleasure, therefore, will be the supreme good. Which is not, you know, he's not an Epicurean, he's not a hedonist here. It's something far more subtle than that. And again, before that, in section 12, he's basically said that pleasure is not this passive thing that we feel because something is happening to us. Pleasure is a doing. Pleasure has something to do with this being actualized.
To me, that's a perfect way to conclude this, what we're talking about right now, because it segues directly into what we're going to talk about next time.
All right. Well, I know one of the reasons, that the things that I was looking to get out of here once I realized that we were going to be reading about phrenesis was, so just recently, I was on another podcast. I appeared on the Seriously Wrong podcast. That's S-R-S-L-Y. And so I listened to a bunch of their episodes, and then listening back to our episodes 5, even though they're less academic and kind of more silly than we are, they're still in their first couple of years of doing this. So I feel like, especially listening to their early stuff, it reminded me of, you know, when we had so much to say and we're not just reading the book and reacting to it as I think we do more now, as opposed to when we started and we just had so much to get off our chests. And so I was a guest on that podcast, and I had to kind of sum up a little bit of like the most useful things I'd gotten out of philosophy and why this would be useful, you know, from sort of a self-help general wisdom perspective. And I brought up the word phrenesis, which we didn't talk about that in our first Aristotle discussion. Maybe it came up in one of our later ones. I think more likely it was something raised by Patricia Churchland or Owen Flanagan, one of our other guests, in talking around ethics and around Aristotle. And I immediately latched onto that. And the way that I characterized this on this other podcast was, you know, at least in terms of doing Simone de Beauvoir recently, made me think about, was for an existentialist, you're not just figuring out, you know, I know what the good is and I'm just figuring out how to get there. It's not just means and analysis. It involves some sort of creativity. And the existentialist picture, Beauvoir building on Nietzsche and stuff, is taken as an update of Aristotle. And so is phrenesis just a matter of, you know what the end is supposed to be, and phrenesis is a matter of the wisdom that you get throughout your life that helps you get to that end? Or is it a matter of actually figuring out the end, tweaking the end? So I posited that really a full understanding of what this wisdom amounts to when you transplant it into this existentialist framework is a matter of, you know, it makes it sound much less revolutionary, that you're not creating values, as Nietzsche says. You're using phrenesis to tweak what's been presented to you as the good and kind of feel your way around it and make your own life and art. And if you look at it that way, as opposed to creating values, then you don't run into these misunderstandings that, you know, you're going to come to the conclusion that rape is actually good or that murder is good or these things that, you know, people dismiss Nietzsche by saying.
Yeah, I think the difference is with Aristotelian phrenesis, you're attuned to your human nature, right? Whereas with a Nietzschean phrenesis, I would be more attuned, or an existentialist phrenesis, more attuned to my West nature, let's say. Although an existentialist, of course, would want to say I have a nature. Exactly. But you get the drift.
Right. It depends who you're talking to. Nietzsche might be more likely to say you have a West nature than de Beauvoir or Sartre. But in any case, if you want to have some guidance and not just be whimsical, and it seems like the way Beauvoir was running is, well, you know, look at what is involved in making a choice. Aren't you also then willing the freedom of others? That in essence comes down to reflecting on what you really want, you know, that you really do want the other people to flourish and that kind of thing. It's doing some sort of phenomenology. It's doing some sort of looking within, even if it's creative. Anyway, so I was interested, given this take on this hypothesis about phrenesis, you know, it was very timely then that we're going actually back to Aristotle to see what he says about phrenesis. And I do find that he is, I think that I can write this a little bit into Aristotle. I mean, with the caveat that you just put on it, Wes, that you're looking at human nature, but that human nature is not necessarily just something that is given, that there's so much detail involved. So like if you are going to figure out how much is too much sexual promiscuity or something like that, that there's not just an answer that you can intuit looking at human nature. Like there really is a matter of the experience of your society and your personal experience and what you read and et cetera, to kind of figure out these very practical norms for yourself. It's not just a matter of hooking ends to means, but it's a similar skill that you would use. It's the same kind of wisdom, this phrenesis, that you would use to hook ends to means as to direct, tweak the ends.
Oh, interesting.
Anyway, so I consider all of my my leaps justified.
Mark feels validated by Aristotle. Come a long way, Mark.
I thought you might hate this.
You know, I can't say it was easy reading. I feel like like has happened with a few other readings recently. Like I started in like, yeah, okay, this is kind of cool. I'm plowing into it. And then after a few days of getting distracted, then I was like, oh my God, I'm going to have to read this all. Oh, it's a good thing we're shortening the reading selection because I'm barely going to get through this. And it really was pretty painful for me to just read the last few pages. I was like, ugh. 9 more pages to go. I'm going to read this aloud to myself just to make myself read it. And then once it's in my head, then I'll, you know, take a few more notes and try to internalize it more. But this book sails along, I think, better than some of the other Aristotle that we've read. And certainly I was prepared for this style of Aristotle. I was not expecting it to be like the Sophist or like the Phaedrus. I was expecting dry, but it was all right. And it's a good thing that I'm not wanting to escape it because we'd already decided, you know, we picked out the reading selection and then we immediately decided on looking at it like and getting into it that this is going to be too much for one podcast. So sorry if you were waiting for Richard Rorty that was supposed to be next, but we're going to do more Aristotle next on friendship in particular.
And I guess probably we'll get to happiness from book 10.
Yes. Friendship and happiness. So everybody should go and debate what you think the coolest Greek word is on our Facebook page, on the blog post associated with this episode at partiallyexaminedlife.com. You can also follow us on Twitter and LinkedIn and all sorts of other things. And thank you to those that have become Partially Examined Life citizens. We're forever grateful to you, or that have otherwise made a donation to us, or, you know, if you were just wanting to give a dollar a month, you could jump on Patreon. We have an option like that there. Anything you can do to, you know, really, there's no contribution that's too great. Aristotle be damned. You should be intemperate with regard to your enthusiasm and financial support for the podcast.
For those who have attended addiction treatment without success, there is hope. The National Institute on Drug Abuse claims there is no single treatment option that is right for everyone. Gulf Breeze Recovery is a non-12-step holistic treatment facility that is successful in helping people break free from the addictive lifestyle. Visit gulfbreezerecovery.com or call 855-6-HOLISTIC-REHAB.
All right. Good night, everybody.
Good night.
Good night.
Like to say something about you, but I have no way to really speak my mind, 'cause English is a language that I haven't used much. What I need to say, I desire, I see require, I need, I care, I fall, I fare fairly well, it's just my mind's in hell. I desire, I see require, I need, I care, I fall, I fare fairly well, it's just my mind's in hell. Heart on my sleeve, leaving a stain. And I don't know how I'll deal with the strain. If the future gets warlike, I hope there's a truce. For now I'm defending remaining streets. I'm chucking a torch down each road alley, following through with a mental drain. Getting back on the road that I've never been off. I'm licking the wounds that I've gouged in my brain. Does it sound insane? Mind I desire, mind I see require. I mean I care, I fall, I fare fairly well. Just my mind's in hell. Mind I desire, I see require. I need, I care, I fall, I fare fairly well. Just my mind's in hell. I've long lost count of the mental I love yous. Guess I don't say them too much anymore. Maybe I'd like to just start it all up again. Maybe that's what I've been singing this for. And torch down each blurred eye, following through with a mental dream. Getting back on the road that I've never been off of. Licking the wounds that I gouged in my brain. Does it sound insane? I desire, I see require. Need, I care, I fall, I fare. Well, it's just my mind's in hell. I desire, I see require. Need, I care, I fall, I fare. Well, it's just my mind's in hell. I desire, I see require. I need, I care, use up my air. I hate those who approach my lair. I live, I die, it's all fair. I fare fairly well.